This could be part of a bigger trend that linguists call colloquialization, which is that writing is becoming more like speech. In other words, it's becoming more informal. Now, that said, as I'm talking about in this lecture, there is still a pretty big gap between the way we speak and the way we write, but they might be getting a little bit closer. I've been doing a study of, however, with Lizzie Hutton, who's a graduate student at the University of Michigan. We were both interested in, however, given just how much students struggle with this issue of how to handle, however. They often want to make, however, behave like but, and just put a comma before it and let it act like a coordinator, rather than putting a semicolon before it and putting a comma after it. And it's not just students who are struggling with, however. The Harvard Review, for instance, announced the following on its submissions webpage. Writers at all stages of their careers are invited to apply, comma, however, comma, we can only publish a very small fraction of the material we receive. There's that however as a coordinator with commas on both sides. Usage guides would tell us that we need a semicolon here before the however, because however is a conjunctive adverb, not a coordinator. They would say we need writers at all stages of their careers are invited to apply, semicolon, however, comma, we can only publish a very small fraction of the material we receive. Given this, Lizzie Hutton and I found ourselves asking, can however be a coordinator? If enough people think it is and treat it like it is, can it become one? Fundamentally, however continues to act like a conjunctive adverb because it can move around within the clause. That hurts our argument about whether or not it can become a coordinator. Let me give you an example of it moving around. We can publish, however, only a very small fraction of the material we receive. But we got curious about why so many writers want to punctuate, however, as if it were a coordinator. It can move around the sentence, yes, but does it tend to occur more often initially, which would make it look and act more like a coordinator? This research that we're doing is ongoing, but I wanted to tell you about it as an example of the kind of grammatical research that one can do about potential changes in the language. We used resources that I've been talking about in this course, the Corpus of Contemporary American English and the Corpus of Historical American English, which allows you to search written language from 1810 until 2009. Then we had to figure out how to search for however as a conjunctive adverb because we needed to rule out sentences like this one. However you want to get there is fine with me. It's a perfectly fine sentence, but it's not the however we're after. As a result, what we searched for was semicolon, however, comma, and period, however, comma. We also searched for comma, however, comma. We were surprised by what we found. Clause initial, however, right there at the beginning of the clause, has risen dramatically over the past 150 years. In other words, it has become more and more common to start a sentence with however. In fact, in the data from the Corpus of Contemporary American English, between 2010 and 2015, sentence initial, however, becomes more common than however in the middle of the sentence or clause. Why does that matter? Why were Lizzie and I so excited when we found that? As however becomes more and more common at the beginning of a sentence, it looks more like a coordinator. That could help explain why so many people treat however as a coordinator. And we're left with the question of whether we can accept that however might be working both as a conjunctive adverb and a coordinator. This research that we've been doing has been generating very interesting conversation with our colleagues as we try to sort through what the data tells or tell us. Now, Did you know that there is a history of prescription about not using however at the beginning of a sentence? I have to say, this is not something that I was taught as a writer at any point in my writing career. But here is William Strunk in the very first edition of Elements of Style, published in 1918. He advises that however, in the meaning nevertheless, is, quote, not to come first in the sentence or clause. In the now classic 1959 version of this book, revised and expanded by E.B. White, this prescription is expanded a little bit. That edition says, avoid starting a sentence with however when the meaning is nevertheless. The word usually serves better when not in first position. Brian Garner, in Modern American Usage, calls however at the beginning of a sentence or clause a stylistic lapse. These criticisms seem a little odd given how common sentence initial however is, even in formal writing. Are editors editing this out? Clearly not. What does the usage panel for American Heritage Dictionary have to say? This was just added to the 2015 ballot. The editors had not surveyed the panel about it before. Only 10% of the usage panel reported that they always follow the rule. Another 30% said that they usually or sometimes follow the rule that you should not begin a sentence or clause with however. 60% said that they rarely or never do so. And I have to say, as you now already know, I was part of that 60%. Clearly, this is a rule that is fading. I wouldn't call it a stylistic lapse. As the restriction on clause initial or sentence initial however fades, and we continue to use clause initial however more frequently, usage guides must now police the use of that semicolon before however. If we're going to use however to connect two clauses and have it start the second clause, they want us to put that semicolon right before the however. This advice is all over the web and all over usage books. And I myself, as a teacher of English, I continue to enforce this rule. We all can and probably will potentially get judged based on our understanding of how to punctuate however. I was very interested, therefore, to know what the usage panel had to say about the rules we follow about punctuating however. The editors of American Heritage added another question under however to see whether or not it was acceptable to punctuate however as a coordinator. The sentence that they gave the panel was this. Main Street will be closed to traffic for the parade, comma, however, comma, the stores along it will remain open. 86% of the panel called this unacceptable. I was part of that 86%. When I did searches of edited writing, it is very hard to find, however, punctuated with those two commas as a coordinator, and I said, right now, that's unacceptable. What I'm struck by is that 14% of the usage panel said it was somewhat or completely acceptable. We'll keep tracking this to see what's going on with however. Let's now turn to how you should introduce a sentence that you want to signal is more important than what precedes it. Should you say, more important, blah, 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 or more importantly, blah, blah, blah? And clearly, whatever blah, blah, blah is important. This came to my attention when a very well-known popular author's mother emailed me with a concern about how he started a sentence in his book. He started the sentence with even more strikingly, and she thought it should be even more striking. This got me digging because I hadn't really thought about this issue before. It turns out that the mother is using the form that is more common in writing, the linking adjective phrase, even more striking. but there aren't good grounds to criticize the conjunctive adverb choice. Let's talk about this issue using more importantly, instead of more strikingly, as the one with important has gotten more attention in usage guides. Even more important and even more importantly both express the writer's stance toward the assertion. The writer believes that whatever they're about to say is more important. If we didn't have the even more there, or just the more, we would want importantly. We wouldn't just put important, comma, and then just keep going. But should we say more important or more importantly? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage traces the debate over more important versus more importantly back to 1968, with some commentators condemning the adverbial phrase, more importantly, and others, including William Safire, concluding that both were acceptable. Why did this come up in the 1960s? I think it's because more importantly was just taking off as a conjunctive adverb. In Google Books, if you search Google Books with the Ngram viewer, you find that more important has been on the rise. It was on the rise for much of the 20th century, and it peaked in about the 1970s. More importantly rose dramatically between 1960 and 2000. And in 2000, it passed more important in Google Books. As commentators were noticing this new thing, as they were noticing that more and more people were using more importantly, they became wary of this new construction. We're seeing exactly the same thing happen with more notable versus more notably. More notably is now more common than more notable. More strikingly is also on the rise, although here more striking remains more common, which is probably why the mother who emailed me may have noticed the more strikingly and thought it was wrong. What we're seeing here, I think, is shifts in language taste and language style. It's about what phrasing we prefer at a given moment in time. To conclude the lecture, I want to talk about a conjunctive adverb that some argue shouldn't even be a word. This would be firstly. Even though the word firstly was in the language at the time, it is not in Samuel Johnson's 1755 dictionary. By the 19th century, firstly was coming to be criticized openly. Now, H.W. Fowler, in his usage guide in the early 20th century, actually comes to the defense of firstly. And as part of his defense, he quotes some of the criticism. He quotes Thomas de Quincey, who wrote in 1847, and here I quote, "I detest your ridiculous and most pedantic neologism of firstly." Thomas Lounsbury wrote about the debate about firstly in Harper's in 1905. He quoted the English poet and writer Walter Savage Landor as saying, "Firstly is not English." But Lounsbury also pointed out that letter writers such as Lady Mary Montagu and Lord Byron both used firstly. It's interesting to think about why we're even debating the question of whether firstly is a word. We don't debate whether secondly is a word or thirdly is a word. Those are totally fine. But for some reason, at some point, people latched on to firstly and said, that one we don't like. Perhaps because it's the first in the row of firstly, secondly, thirdly. But it does show the ways in which our social judgments of words are idiosyncratic. That we will pick one word, in this case one word out of a lineup, and say that one's not a word, whereas the other ones in the sequence are okay. There's also the question of, for you, when does that sequence stop being okay? Firstly, secondly, thirdly, fourthly, that one's okay for me. Fifthly, sixthly, for me, by the time we get to seventhly, I'm really struggling. I don't like it anymore. I need to be doing sixth, seventh. Given this discussion of firstly, are you now wondering if thusly is okay? According to the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel, not so much. The word thusly was created in the 1800s, and it looks like it was created primarily by humorists as a signal of uneducated usage. In other words, they were putting it into the speech of people they were trying to characterize in particular ways. From there, thusly got picked up in more educated usage. Beware of the words you create, you never know what's going to happen to them. And it got picked up with the meaning in such a way. Thusly is still in the language, meaning that. Here is an example from Newsweek from 2009. President Martin Van Buren described the economic crisis of 1837 in Britain and America thusly. In other words, he described it in such a way. So there's thusly in Newsweek. What happened when thusly was given to the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel? It was on the survey in 2002, and the panel was given the following sentence. His letter to the editor ended thusly. It is time to stop fooling ourselves. 88% of the panel rejected it. 88% rejected thusly used this way. Given that, I would say that this is an adverb to be wary of. How did you like that preposition at the end of my sentence? I'm going to claim it was a conscious choice, as the next two lectures are all about prepositions, including a whole lecture devoted to the idea that you shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition.
Lecture 17, Squirrels and Prepositions.
It is always interesting to me what language pet peeves jump to mind when people meet me and find out what I do. Last fall, I was at a tailgate for a football game at the University of Michigan, and I met an alumna who was a retired teacher. And we talked about what I did at the university, and she then said, "Oh, you know, what always gets to me is people who say different than instead of different from." I was struck that this was the pet peeve that first jumped to mind for this former teacher. That said, I have a colleague in my department at the University of Michigan who has very strong feelings that it should be different from, not different than. At the same time, I have several other colleagues in the department who don't have strong feelings at all about whether it should be different from or different than. I haven't yet surveyed everyone in the department, yet. This conversation I've been having about different from and different than with my colleagues reminds me of what students are navigating as they move among, or between, we'll come back to that, classes where professors have different usage issues that they notice. It's especially hard for students if professors have policies about, for example, losing X number of points for 2 or 3 grammatical errors per page. As this course has been making abundantly clear, people who know and people who care a lot about grammar do not all agree on what is an error or a stylistic lapse or an ill-advised choice, whether those people are writing usage guides or serving on the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel or editing academic journals or newspapers. In the case we're talking about here, students are navigating the choice between two prepositions, from and than. And students will have routinely heard both different from and different than in spoken American English. This lecture is all about prepositions. And let's start by unpacking the concern about different than. What I hear most often is that the adjective different does not set up a comparison or on a scale the way that something like more than or less than does. So than is inappropriate. With different, we are distinguishing one thing from another thing. In addition, we say that X differs from Y, so we should say X is different from Y, not X is different than Y. Of course, one could make the argument that difference is a form of comparison. We have to compare things to see that they're different. But I understand the point, that it is not comparison on a continuum the way that more and less work. The argument that because X differs from Y means that it should be X is different from Y isn't completely persuasive to me. Prepositions don't necessarily hold across parts of speech. For example, we sympathize with others, but express sympathy for others. One fundamental issue at play here is that prepositions in English are not a totally rational bunch of words. Instead, they are highly idiomatic. Think about this. Why is it due to? Why isn't it due by? I think you could argue that would make just as much sense. Why is it in addition instead of on addition or by addition or through addition? In any case, let's return to different from versus different than. First, we need to add to the mix different to, which is widely used in British English, and again highlights how idiomatic usage is with prepositions. Different to is the oldest of the three. It goes back to the 16th century. Different than goes back to the 17th century, and different from appears about the same time. All three appear to have been in standard usage. So when did different than start to get criticized? It looks like it starts with Robert Baker in Reflections on the English Language, published in 1770. He calls different than not English. This criticism is not widely picked up until the end of the 19th century, and then different than comes to be widely critiqued. It remains a construction that many editors in the U.S. will correct toward different from, but not all the time. Since the mid-20th century, people have been opting for different than when it is followed by a clause rather than a noun phrase. I would guess you do too, and let me show you what I mean. Let's look at examples to show when you might want to use different than rather than different from, depending on whether you have a clause or a noun phrase. Let's start with a noun phrase. Take this sentence. Millennials aren't all that different from Gen Xers. This could also be than. Millennials aren't all that different than Gen Xers, but that's the one that gets criticized. But now let's look at it with a clause. Social norms for Gen Xers are different than they were for millennials. Are different than they were for millennials. We don't want to use from here. This, I think, doesn't sound right. Social norms for Gen Xers are different from they were for millennials. The only way to use from here is to do a somewhat awkward rewrite to get a noun phrase after from. We could say social norms for Gen Xers are different from the way they were for millennials. Or social norms for Gen Xers are different from how they were for millennials. In sum, different from, different than, different to can all be considered within the realm of standard, especially if we look at speech, and all have been used by well-known authors for several centuries. Different from is still often seen as the most formal and perhaps the most standard in written American English, but there's nothing wrong with different than, and it is the standard alternative when there's a clause following it instead of a noun phrase. I recognize that you may have been looking for more definitive advice about what is right and wrong with different from versus different than, but I just can't responsibly give it to you. You will run into editors who care about this one and editors who don't care about this one. And if educated usage is your guide, you will find a mixed bag. You'll find both different from and different than even when you have a noun phrase after it. Rather than feel frustrated by the fact that there isn't a clear-cut right or wrong answer here, perhaps this is a place where we can all enjoy the flexibility that is sometimes allowed within the formal standard. Before we go any further, I want to note another example that shows that attitudes about which preposition is the correct one change over time. We now say sympathize with someone, but feel sympathy for someone. That is now totally standard. And while we can say feel sympathy with someone, it is much more common to say feel sympathy for someone. It might surprise you to know that in the 19th century, the essayist Thomas De Quincey called sympathy for, to feel sympathy for someone, a monstrous barbarism. Prepositions may be little words, but let it not be said that people do not care about their prepositions. This seems like an apt moment to step back and define prepositions, more specifically than little words. And I realize it may not be reassuring for me to say that I don't have a very good definition of what a preposition is, and it's not just me. Prepositions are notoriously hard to define, and yet English grammar at this point is highly dependent on them. For those of you who remember Grammar Rock, there is the song Busy Prepositions. It compares prepositions with busy bees and ants, because they're such an important part of the language. The song goes on in the chorus to list the busiest of the prepositions, of, on, to, with, in, from, by, for, at, over, across. Many years ago, when I was teaching prepositions in a class on grammar, and I was asking the students what definitions they had learned, one student gave me this definition that he had learned from a teacher in seventh grade. A preposition is everything a squirrel can do with respect to a tree. I love that. It accounts for prepositions such as up, down, in, around, toward, to, into, over, under, behind, at, beside, near. The squirrel is doing all those things with respect to the tree. But it doesn't account for some other prepositions, like since, or including, during, unlike, until. Although the sentence, the squirrel was until the tree, is kind of a wonderful sentence, that poor squirrel. Here is a very common definition of a preposition. I've taken this from Margaret Schertzer's The Elements of Grammar, and here I'll quote. A preposition is a connecting word that shows the relation of a noun or pronoun to some other word in a sentence. So she says noun or pronoun. It probably would be more accurate to say the relationship of a noun phrase to other words in the sentence. Here's Strunk and White in the fourth edition of Elements of Style. And they say a preposition is a word that relates its object, a noun, pronoun, or ing verb form, to another word in the sentence. You're getting the theme here. This is about relationships between nouns or noun-like things and something else in the sentence. Here's the Riverside Handbook. Prepositions show relationships between words, often relationships over time and space. So, prepositions, here's one thing we can say, are always followed by a noun phrase. Be that a noun, pronoun, gerund, and they show relationships. One grammar guide tells us a preposition isn't a preposition unless it has that related noun or pronoun as its object. This is the standard way of looking at prepositions, that they require a noun phrase after them. And you'll find it in pretty much every dictionary and every grammar book, except for one. This would be Rodney Huddlestone and Jeff Pullum's Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. This is a magisterial work. It is a descriptive grammar that runs hundreds and hundreds of pages as they try to capture what we actually do in English grammar. And they're also trying to help us rethink some of our terminology. They trouble this definition of a preposition and the distinction between prepositions and conjunctions. We'll come back to this at the end of the lecture. As noted, prepositions often show relationships in terms of time and location. Let me show you some examples. Prepositions that show relationships in time. This would be things like before today, after midnight, since 1980, during the Cold War, at 3 o'clock. All those little prepositions are helping us understand where we are in relation to time. They can also help us know where we are in relation to location. Over the river, through the woods, inside the house, beneath the stairs. Prepositions also can show comparison and other distinctions. For example, unlike Harry Potter, except that one, excluding money. They also can focus our attention. For example, regarding this situation. Or they set up oppositions. Think about a preposition like versus. Prepositions can also do grammatical work similar to the work that inflectional endings carry. Or at least that inflectional endings historically carried. Here's one example. We have the possessive of in English. And we also have that possessive final S as in ands. In English, we can show possession, therefore, through that final S or through of, which means we can say John's book or the name of the ship. Now here is an interesting usage issue, double possessives. In some ways, these double possessives should be criticized, but they're not. Is it a friend of Kate's or a friend of Kate? For me, it is much more colloquial to say a friend of Kate's, but it's doubly marked. You have the of and you have the possessive S. So is it wrong? Some would relegate these double possessives to informal contexts, but you can find them in more formal ones. And there are a few double possessives that are mandatory. For example, a friend of mine, where you have of and you have the possessive pronoun mine. But you wouldn't say a friend of me. So when the object of is a personal pronoun, you're going to get a double possessive. Interestingly, some single possessive alternatives are problematic, and not all double possessives are idiomatic. Here's an instance where the single possessive doesn't sound right. Let's imagine that we're talking about Kate's bicycle instead of Kate's friend. As you recall, we could say a friend of Kate's or a friend of Kate. But while we can say a bicycle of Kate's, I think most of us cannot say a bicycle of Kate. On the flip side, we have double possessives that don't sound right. We can say the name of the ship, but not the name of the ships. There's a detailed treatment of this issue of double possessives by Grammar Girl, whose name is Mignon Fogarty, and she has a blog, a website called Grammar Girl. And it's a really nice blog. It really strives to provide relatively balanced grammar advice with some historical perspective. The blog post on double possessives describes a general rule that the object must be human in order to take a double possessive, which would explain why we wouldn't say the name of the ships. Grammar Girl then gives the example that we can't say a friend of the museums. But in fact, if you search actual usage, and you may already be thinking this, you can find examples of a friend of the museums. I don't know if that's because museum is representing a set of people or somehow the museum is personified there. So, it is generally a solid rule about when we can and can't get double possessives that what comes after the of needs to be human. But being the creative speakers that we are, there are also exceptions, like a friend of the museums. As I mentioned before, prepositions are highly idiomatic, as anyone who has taught or learned English as a second or foreign language can tell you. And I know this from having taught English as a second language myself. My students would ask, when is it a story about versus a story of? And I really had no good explanation. And then we could add to the mix that if we do a feature story, it's a feature on something. While we're at it, why is it on purpose but by accident? And here I do want to note that things are changing, which you would know if you talk with teenagers or younger children who now, more often than not, do things on accident. Well, it may not be fair to say more often than not, but certainly a lot of them are now doing things on accident that is coming into the language. And I would guess that in the long run, if we take the long view, on accident will win. My brother-in-law, in response to this, is now threatening to say, by purpose. Let's now turn to two other usage issues, between versus among, and toward versus towards. Then we'll end by looking at a fascinating change with the word because. The rule about when to use between and when to use among can seem straightforward. Use between for two things, and among for three or more things. Let's imagine you're at a restaurant for dinner. You're perusing the menu in the older sense of that term. You're reading it carefully. You narrow it down and you are now choosing between salmon and tuna for dinner. Or let's imagine that you're having trouble narrowing it down, in which case you are choosing among the many entrees on the menu. But you know by now that when I say a rule seems straightforward, that all odds are that I'm then going to say that it isn't. Here's another way to think about this rule about between and among. Use between when we are talking about two things, and then you can use between or among when talking about three or more things. Whether you want to use between or among with three or more things depends on whether you're talking about those things individually or in terms of their relationship in pairs, in which case you would use between, or whether you are talking about all of the things and their relationship collectively, in which case you would use among. According to this principle, I could say that I am choosing between the salmon, tuna, and swordfish for dinner. I'm looking at each of those individually. If you're thinking, but that's wrong, that's not the way I learned it, you need to know that style guides won't consistently back you up on this. And although etymologically between goes back to by two, it has been used for more than two things since Old English. On the Oxford Dictionary's blog, they talk about the way in which, according to them, we should say a treaty was drawn up between France, Germany, Italy, and Greece, because we're talking about the individual relationships there. But we would say there was agreement among the members of NATO. Strunk and White and Elements of Style are on the same page. They note that usually when there are more than two, we should use among. But when it is about individual relationships, use between. Brian Garner in Modern American Usage reminds us that between is the only word we have to describe the relationship of a thing or person to many other things severally and individually. Then several commentators on this question point out the difference between Anne ran among the cars and Anne ran between the cars. Anne ran among the cars suggests me weaving in and out of the cars, whereas Anne ran between the cars suggests perhaps two lines of cars and I'm running down the middle. While we're at it, let me just say that I now read amongst in a lot of student papers. Brian Garner says that amongst is now old-fashioned and even pretentious, but I would keep your eye on this one. There is something afoot with amongst. I also now see a lot of towards in student writing in addition to toward. The bottom line here is that both are standard. Towards, with an S, is more British, and toward, without an S, is more American. Someone once told me to remember it by thinking that the Brits like to make the word longer, which is actually not a very helpful way to remember it, and yet I do. When I searched Google Books with the Ngram viewer to see what was going on here, what I found was an upswing in toward in British English, and since 2000, an upswing in towards the British form in American English. So perhaps at some point we'll meet in the middle. Right now, you really can't go wrong with either one. Throughout this lecture, I've been talking about changes in preposition usage and perhaps form, such as toward and towards. But I haven't talked about making new prepositions, and that's because we almost never do. Prepositions are a closed class. They don't tend to admit new members. Now, of course, historically, we have occasionally had borrowings of prepositions, such as during, which came into English from Old French. And every once in a while, a participle will become a preposition, such as considering. Than was historically a conjunction, and now can also be used as a preposition, although not all grammarians agree on that one. In this context, linguists are very interested in what is happening with the word because, and they have been debating how to describe this new or expanded usage of because. This would be the because that we see in something like because science or because internet. Here's one of my favorite examples. I can't diet because chocolate. Or students will say to me, I'm stressed because exams. Now maybe you're thinking, I can't use because that way. And I have to say, I can't really use because that way. I know it's out there and I can do it now as a joke, but it's not really part of my grammar. I need a full clause after because, not just a noun phrase. And it can be more than a noun phrase. This new use of because can also occur with adjectives and with interjections. For example, because tired, because arg. Can a preposition do that? Jeff Pullum says yes. The linguist blogger Gretchen McCulloch says no. Here are Pullum's examples to show that a preposition can do this with an adjective or an interjection or an adverb. He says, look at, I've moved on from frustrated, which sounds perfectly grammatical to me. He also gives us this example. There is no way to do this except cautiously. Now, one could argue that you have ellipsis here, that you're just leaving out the rest of the clause. But colloquially, at least, we can follow a preposition with adjectives and adverbs, as well as interjections. Pullum is actually making a bigger argument here. He says that because has always been a preposition, rather than a subordinating conjunction or a subordinator, and that we need to recognize that prepositions can be followed by noun phrases, by clauses, by prepositional phrases, or by nothing. He then looks at because and says, because has traditionally been followed by a clause or by a prepositional phrase that starts with of. For example, because of the cold. Pullum then interprets what we're now seeing with because as an expansion of its function, that it can now take on noun phrases and pronouns and maybe adjectives. I recognize that this distinction of how to think about because as a subordinator or a preposition gets a little technical, but I appreciate that within the field of linguistics, linguists continue to debate what is the correct terminology to capture the most appropriate categories to describe English grammar most accurately. Members of the American Dialect Society, which is an academic society to which I belong, were so interested in what is happening with because that we voted because plus noun as the word of the year for 2013. Now, we've been voting on the word of the year for about 25 years now. We vote every year in January at our annual meeting. And this is a gathering of, it used to be fairly small, maybe about 60. Now you get several hundred people in the room. And we consider new words of that year. Now these could be words that are completely new, or they could be words that are newly prominent to a given year. In the past, we have voted for example, Y2K as the word of the year for 1999. Chad was the word of the year in 2000. Other words of the year include bailout, subprime, app, hashtag. For the year 2015, it was singular they, in particular as it is used as the term of choice for individuals who identify outside the male-female binary. In 2013, it was because plus noun. Now, this choice was a little hard to explain to the press, that we left our vote and the press said, what's the word of the year? And we said, because. And they looked at us like, what kind of word of the year is that? That's not new. But what we were trying to capture here is that we were interested in this new use of because plus noun. It took a little explaining, but they were very interesting conversations to have. And we voted for it as the word of the year because when you think about it, it really is a historical oddity for because to become a preposition or to expand its prepositional reach. Given that, it seemed like a great choice as the word of the year. And I want to note here that it beat out slash. Slash was the runner-up as a new coordinator. 2013 gave us some very interesting choices to think about as what should be the word of the year. And I was struck that we had two new function words competing for the title. We're finished with this lecture, but we're not finished with prepositions. In the next lecture, we'll turn to probably the best known rule about prepositions. Don't end a sentence with one. Or, prepositions are words you shouldn't end sentences with.
Lecture 18, Stranded Prepositions.
There's a joke about prepositions out there that people tell me every few months, given that they know I appreciate a good grammar joke. It goes like this. A first-year student is on Harvard's campus and asks a senior, "Excuse me, can you tell me where the library's at?" The senior replies haughtily, "At Harvard, we do not end a sentence with a preposition." The first-year student tries again, "Can you tell me where the library's at, jerk?" And that's the tame version of the joke. I actually usually hear the joke with a less tame insult there at the end of the question. The rule in question here is about not ending a sentence with a preposition, and it is one of the most widely known rules. It comes up whenever I ask students about the rules that they have learned in high school, along with the rule not to split an infinitive and not to use the first-person pronoun I in formal writing. We're going to spend this entire lecture talking about this rule because it is so well known and so widely enforced. And yet, there's confusion about when it should apply and whether it's a worthwhile rule to follow at all. Let's start with what's going on in the joke. The question, "Where is the library at?" ends in a preposition. But the concern about this construction is not really about the preposition. I think the concern is about the redundancy of where plus at. So in that way, it is about the preposition, but it's not about whether it's stranded. It's about whether it's redundant with the where. And the at in "where's it at" isn't stranded. It's just extra. Now, we could reword the question to get a stranded preposition. If we reworded the question this way, "Which library are we meeting at?" that would be stranded. I call it a stranded preposition, and let me explain what I mean here. In the last lecture, we talked about how a prepositional phrase is a preposition plus a noun phrase. The preposition gets stranded when the noun phrase moves up to the front of the clause. For example, which library are we meeting at? From, if you undo that, you would get, we are meeting at which library? There are two times that prepositions can get stranded at the end, that this kind of fronting can happen. It can happen in what we call WH questions and in relative clauses. Let's start with those WH questions. WH questions involve the interrogative pronouns who, what, where, when, why, and how. You can see why we call them WH questions, except for the how, which we just sort of tack on, but who, what, where, when, why. Now, these interrogative pronouns get put at the front of the question, no matter what function the interrogative pronoun plays in the sentence or in the question. Now, if the interrogative pronoun is the subject, it's already going to be up there in the front. Who made dinner? It's the subject, already there in the front. But if it's in object position, it still needs to move up to the front. Let's look at a question with an object relative pronoun, and I'm going to start by leaving it in object position. You ate what for dinner? And we can do that, especially if we're trying to be emphatic. But the generic form of the question would be, what did you eat for dinner? Where the what gets fronted, moved up to the front of the question. So, if the interrogative pronoun is the object of a preposition, it still fronts with or without the preposition. Let's look at an example, first with the question in a form where the interrogative pronoun is still positioned as the object of the preposition. You cooked dinner for whom? Now let's front the object of the preposition. Whom did you cook dinner for? Or, as we've already talked about, perhaps, who did you cook dinner for, if you would rather use a who there. Now, we could also front the preposition with the interrogative pronoun and get, for whom did you cook dinner? Both of those questions, who or whom did you cook dinner for, and for whom did you cook dinner, are completely grammatical in English in the descriptive sense. The question is whether we find it more pleasing to front the preposition to. As you know, the term in linguistics for this kind of fronting of the preposition is pied piping, where the preposition follows its pronoun up to the front of the sentence. We talked about that in Lecture 7 when we were talking about relative clauses. Speaking of relative clauses, that same kind of fronting happens in those relative clauses with which. For example, let's take this sentence. That is the house that I was telling you about. Okay? There, it's stranded. But let me undo that to show you what's happened. Here's the sentence. That is the house that I was telling you about. Here we see the relative pronoun that has gotten fronted, and the about is still there. Let me undo that sentence and get the relative pronoun back into its position as the object of the preposition. That is the house, and now here comes the relative clause. I was telling you about that house. Then the that gets fronted. That is the house that I was telling you about. Let's imagine now that we also want to front the preposition about. We would get, that is the house about which I was telling you. Both of these sentences are also fully grammatical. Although I will admit that the second one, the house about which I was telling you, sounds very formal to me. That about which is formal. I have to say, if I use an about which, it feels like one of those moments that could make me sound a little English professory, and sounding like an English professor isn't always great for my social life. Now, as I'm noting here, there is a difference between speech and writing, And we might be more likely to Pied Pipe that preposition to bring it up to get about which in writing, and more likely to strand it in speech. A quick reminder here of something I mentioned in Lecture 7 when we were talking about relative clauses. You may have noticed that something else odd happened in that example sentence about the house. In the relative clause, we had "that I was telling you about," and then when we fronted the "about," it turned into "about which I was telling you," not "about that I was telling you." This is just one of those things about English, that when the relative pronoun "that" gets fronted to appear after the preposition, it turns into "which." Okay, so we've clarified when a preposition might get stranded. And we know that there's a rule out there that we shouldn't strand it at the end of a sentence or the end of a question. Where did that rule come from? It looks like, to answer that question, we need to talk about John Dryden. It's amazing to think that one person could be responsible for such a long-standing grammatical tradition. And it may well not be true that we can pin this on John Dryden, but it makes for a good story. John Dryden, who also proposed a language academy in the 1660s, he wanted an academy to control this language, to keep our grammar in order. He's usually cited as the first to notice and to disparage the stranded preposition. In 1672, he picked out for critique the writing of Ben Jonson. And I love it when we do this, that we pick out another writer, and then we say, look at what they're doing, they shouldn't be doing that. Now, here's the line from Jonson that Dryden was concerned about. "The bodies that those souls were frighted from." Frighted from. Dryden commented, "The preposition in the end of the sentence, a common fault with him, and which I have but lately observed in my own writings." Dryden subsequently not only avoided stranded prepositions in his own prose, but went back and revised earlier work that contained stranded prepositions so that his earlier work wouldn't have those stranded prepositions. Interestingly, if we go back to Ben Jonson's 1640 grammar, and yes, Ben Jonson did write a grammar, not everyone knows that, we see that Jonson very descriptively notes this about prepositions. He says that they follow sometimes the nouns that they are coupled with. And note how cleverly he does exactly that right there, that he strands a preposition. The nouns they are coupled with. So the noun is coming before the preposition instead of after. He could have said the nouns with which they are coupled, but he chose not to. Joseph Priestley, in his grammar, says very much the same thing. And as you may recall, his grammar was published in 1761. It's called The Rudiments of English Grammar. And here's what he writes. Prepositions generally precede their substantives, as in, he went to London. But sometimes a verb more elegantly parts them, as, this is the thing with which I am pleased, or this is the thing which I am pleased with. So in 1761, Priestley is allowing for stylistic variation, saying that sometimes it's more elegant to strand the preposition. But Priestley's view lost to Bishop Louth's opinion on the construction, which was written down and disseminated in his English Grammar, published in 1762. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's important to hear how Bishop Louth explains what has now become a rule. So here's Louth. "The preposition is often separated from the relative which it governs and joined to the verb at the end of the sentence, or of some member of it, as," and here he quotes, "Horace is an author whom I am much delighted with." And here's another quote he puts in. "The world is too well bred to shock authors with a truth, which generally their booksellers are the first that inform them of." And he said that's from Pope, preface to the poems. And here Loth continues. This is an idiom which our language is strongly inclined to. It prevails in common conversation and suits very well with the familiar style in writing. But the placing of a preposition before the relative is more graceful.